Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin, an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international coach, and resident stat guy.
Rounds 1 and 2 of the NCAA volleyball tournament finished on Saturday, and there were a lot of entertaining matches, so we have a lot to dive into there. Also, we're going to take a look at the PVF draft that happened a couple weeks ago and answer some listener questions, which may help people as they watch the regionals matches this week. There is a lot to cover, so let's get started.
So this week we saw rounds 1 and 2 of the NCAA playoffs happen. Now let's go through this starting in order. We'll look at round one matches that maybe didn't go as expected, and then we'll move into the round two matches, and there were some serious upsets, including bracket busters for both of us.
My bracket got busted in the very first match of this tournament, dang it.
Yeah, it's not looking great. The thing I realized looking at the results was I watched a lot of volleyball, but I didn't watch enough volleyball because there were teams that I hadn't seen play who were very good, and I wish we would have known or seen them a little bit earlier in the season.
So round one, notable highlights here. Loyola Chicago beat the 5-seed BYU 3 straight.
Claire Little did not have a great game. She only hit 086 on 35 sets. And I think the story there was Loyola Chicago outdug BYU 53-37.
We watched this game, and Loyola Chicago would literally get hit by the ball, and it would be controlled. Like, I was watching it, and part of me just felt bad for BYU. I honestly, at the beginning, based on body language and stuff, I got the impression that they thought that they were going to roll through that match. Is it true? I don't know. Can't say for sure. I'm just talking about what I observed. But I wouldn't say BYU played, like, terrible, but there were some things. Everything was going Loyola Chicago's way, like broken plays, plays that had no business, like, trickling over the net, getting pelted with swings in their control. Like, I felt bad for BYU.
It was interesting watching BYU's body language in that match because the roll off the tape would happen, the tip just over the block would happen, and you could see them trying to shake it off, but it looked a little laissez-faire, and they just never seemed to hit their stride or be able to bounce back from all of those little plays not going their way.
So that's the match that just really set things off for my bracket. Toast before we even began. The other round one surprise, maybe highlight, I don't know, was that Ole Miss defeated the 7-seed Florida State 3-2.
Now this game was very close by the numbers. We saw Sasha Ratcliffe hit 458 on 24 sets, and we had Peyton Bergotch go 500 on 30 sets. They also had Nia Washington get 43 and Shayla Meyer go 39 sets. So they distributed their offense really well, and they had a couple hitters who played incredibly well with really good numbers. I think the difference for me looking at this match was Ole Miss had 19 blocks to Florida State's 8 and outdug them 66-56. In a close match where sets are decided by 2 points, those stats make a difference.
I mean, it's impressive how evenly distributed the Ole Miss offense was. Like, the two players you mentioned at the beginning, Ratcliffe and Bergotch, are middles. That's good numbers, and they got set similar amount to the outsides.
Yeah, one that was a testament to their ball control in that match. They had the option to run those two players, and they performed. We saw Corey Lewis for Florida State also had a good game, hit 486 on 35 sets. And Taylor Head went 229 on 48, which was also a decent performance.
I mean, we saw about half of this match, and it was a good volleyball. Like, there wasn't anything that we were just like scratching our heads, you know?
Yeah, there were no glaring mistakes or missteps. It was just high level volleyball, and Ole Miss made plays down the stretch when it counted. Those are the two noticeable upsets in round one. But let me tell you, round two got intense. There were some amazing matches. We're going to talk about those a little bit later. But man, what a great 3 days of volleyball.
As we mentioned last week, we are going to go over the PVF draft that happened. It's a very exciting time. You're finishing your college career. You have the opportunity to play at the professional level at home, meaning not having to go overseas. So I think this is a big deal. So we just wanted to touch on that draft and like the notable, you know, things that happened with that.
So in looking into the draft, I thought it was important to have some background information about the league. I personally didn't know much about it. I'm assuming some of our listeners do, but some of them may not. So I'm going to hit you with the highlights of the league, and then we can get into the draft. So PVF has 8 teams in their league: Atlanta, Columbus, Grand Rapids, Indy, Omaha, Orlando, San Diego, and Vegas. Now, the draft was 5 rounds, so 40 players total. For those of you who are interested, the league starts in January, goes until May. Now, this part was interesting and affects draft decisions, in my opinion. They play with 8 substitutions. So FIVB is 6, NCAA is 15. So what we're going to see is teams needing to draft players that can play a full 6 rotations. That's very different from the college game, and I think the smart teams will have taken that into consideration. A couple other interesting things about the PVF for people to know is it's a 24-match season. They have a 14-player roster with a maximum of 2 foreign players. So they need to have and fill their rosters with players from the U.S. It's a 4-team playoff, so your regular season really matters. Now, we didn't watch any of the league last year, so we don't know anything about the teams. But from my understanding, and if anyone knows differently, please correct me, the players are not required to play in this league. So it's different than other major sports where you declare for the draft and the team that gets you, you don't have any option other than to play with them. These athletes can be drafted and then decide to go play professionally overseas. They can decide to go play for another league, or they could decide just not to show up. So it's not a true skill choice necessarily. You have to take into consideration whether this athlete is going to choose to play for your team, and that includes location, team, coach, all of those things. So there's probably a lot of conversations that go on with these players that we don't see or know about going into the draft.
Yeah, I mean, as Adam said, we didn't follow the PVF last season. We know, you know, who won, who played in the final last year, but other than that, we didn't really follow too closely. You know, building off of what you were saying, there are obviously some notable senior athletes that were not in the draft. Sarah Franklin, Lexi Rodriguez, 2 that are just off the top of my head. So when I was watching the draft and stuff, I was wondering, you know, this is also a curiosity and a question, if any of our listeners out there have the answer, is I know that these athletes have affiliations with Love. I don't know if they have made commitments to play Love or play overseas. I know you were saying that if a player is drafted, they don't necessarily have to play. So maybe they just knew that they weren't interested in playing in that league. And so they're like, do not put my name on the list. Like, the pool of athletes, we aren't sure of the details of exactly who was in it. And I think a notable thing to mention is Jess Merzik was the last pick in the 5th round. So like that kind of also adds into it. Like, let's hedge our bets. Like, maybe she'll come, maybe not, but like maybe she'll make a different choice. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah, let's talk about the round one draft order, and then we can kind of build on what you were saying as far as international rules and why we think certain decisions were made.
So if we look at the first round, we saw Atlanta choose Merritt Beeson.
Which is interesting. Let me just jump in. Didn't even give him a second there. Nebraska. Atlanta's actually coached by Caleb Banworth, who is a former Nebraska Cornhusker. Coincidence? I think not. I mean, Beeson's a good player, obviously. But yeah, just interesting.
Indianapolis chose Anna DeBeer from Louisville. Orlando, Nora Siss from Creighton. Vegas, Cameron Hanna from Penn State. San Diego, Devin Robinson from Wisconsin. Atlanta, Corey Lewis from FSU. Grand Rapids, Raven Colvin from Purdue. And Omaha, Toyosi Anabanjo from Kansas.
So, as you were mentioning, because the substitution rules are closer to international volleyball than NCAA, we need, or teams are going to need, players that are reliable for six rotations.
So when we look at the college game and the number of substitutions, what you generally see is players who will come in, play three rotations in the front row, very good attackers, very good blockers. Then they go out and they're replaced by a DS. And those DS players play three rotations on the back and then come back out. And because of the number of substitutions, you can rotate them in and out all match. That is not the case when it comes to a more international substitution rule. So we actually have a player in the first round who got chosen, and I was a little surprised. You had Devin Robinson, who plays that for Wisconsin. You also have Anna Smrek, who was drafted later on, who plays that same role. These players are really hard to choose high in the draft because you really only get them for one rotation unless they develop their full volleyball skills.
So what you're seeing are, like, Merritt Beeson is, she doesn't necessarily play six rotations for Nebraska, but she is capable. You know, she's a threat offensively from the back row. Anna DeBeer, six rotation player. Cameron Hanna, like, we don't know exactly what each individual team needs or was looking for, but typically in the pro level, you do see point scorers going first, and I would say that this is the case. Clearly, Atlanta, Grand Rapids, Omaha, they all picked middle blockers who went at the bottom of round one, so they clearly had a need for that position. But it also brings up the libero discussion. For example, Elena Scott went at the top of round two, outstanding libero. But because she's not scoring points for a team, it is very rare to see a libero go early. So that's the explanation. I agree with you. Looking at this list, I have no comments. It makes sense to me, other than Devin Robinson.
I agree with you looking at Devin Robinson. The thing to think about that we don't see, maybe she's a six rotation player in practice. We don't see it at the NCAA level. Obviously, the DS is a better defender than she is, but she could be capable and just not given a chance in matches. So I'm assuming that GMs and coaches have done their homework. They've talked to coaches. You know, Devin Robinson can play in the back row. She might need a little practice, but it's probably close. That would be my best reasoning through that choice.
With Love starting up this season too, I'm very interested to compare the two leagues. You know, Love has backing from really big names, national team athletes, those like founding athletes of the program. And then when we go through the rosters of PVF, you know, we're not seeing necessarily like powerhouse schools represented across the board, or even athletes that we recognize. So, I mean, the same can be said for Love too. I've looked at some of the rosters and I'm kind of like, has this person played in the last decade? But yeah, I'm very curious to see the Love model with their national team athletes and PVF and how they're doing things.
Well, there's a couple other things now that you brought Love up that people should know. The PVF is running like a normal professional league. So they have locations, they have teams. There is nothing about the sport other than those professional teams, and they're trying to make that work. Love has taken a different approach where they have bought youth clubs. They're trying to run a developmental system from club volleyball through to college and then into the professional league. So it's a more holistic approach to the development of volleyball. And I think that's where you see a lot of the national team athletes get involved, because they're helping grow the game from the grassroots. They're trying to increase the number of girls who play sport and the visibility, and then work through that progression of club to university to pro. And so we have two different approaches, and it will be interesting to see which one lasts, which one takes hold, which one gains popularity. I think we're going to see several years of them competing, and my guess would be eventually we'll see an amalgamation of those two leagues into one set pro league.
Since the PBF athletes aren't required to play if they're drafted, I'm willing to bet that this first round group, the GMs and coaches were pretty sure that they're getting a commitment from these athletes. So I'm excited to watch these newly graduated athletes compete at the professional level and see how that transition goes for them from the NCAA. But yeah, we're going to be following both the PBF and Love this season. So stay tuned in the new year for more on that.
All right, let's get into the meat of the show with our second round matchups. Unsurprisingly, Pitt, Stanford, Nebraska, Texas, Purdue, and Creighton all cruised through their second round matchups.
And first round.
3-0. No hiccups, no blips.
Pretty much as expected, I would say. I would say the only thing, like, maybe people could have had question marks about Texas, USC. I will say that is the one thing that I didn't mess up in my bracket.
Well, we all knew Texas has championship pedigree. It was just a matter of, did they have enough runway to get it together and to gel? And so far, the answer is yes.
Penn State dropped a set to North Carolina in their second round. And Wisconsin dropped a set to Georgia Tech in their second round. For the most part, the teams we expected to take care of business took care of business.
And that is where the predictability stopped this year.
Yes.
Let's get into a few of them. We watched, I think, 5 matches front to back this week. We'll talk about those in a little bit more depth. But we also saw Marquette beat Utah in 5. That was a 4-5 matchup. So I'm not sure it was an upset, but we saw Marquette hit 424 in the first set, which they won. And then they won the second set hitting 091, which seems a little strange to me. And they ended up winning the 5th set hitting 087. Looking at the error totals, Marquette made 39 hitting errors to Utah's 24, and they were outblocked 7-17, but they had 19 more digs. So it seems like it was a very strange match.
Let's just give sets away. Let's just give them away with straight up hitting errors. Once we saw that Marquette was up 2-0, we tuned in. So we caught partway through the 4th and the 5th. It was wild. Okay. I think Marquette was up like 24-20.
Yes.
24-19, actually, correct, in the 4th set to close out this match. And then Utah sided out.
And won 26-24.
And won 26-24. We were hooked at that point. We had to finish it out.
And then the 5th set was 15-12. And like I said, Marquette hit 087 in the 5th set, which was better than Utah's 0. So it wasn't necessarily a very high execution level. They battled it out and they kept going, and Marquette ended up winning that one.
Jardine showed up for me. The right side for Utah, I think she's single-handedly won that 4th set for them. And then every time she came in, she's a front row player because Utah runs a 6-2. Every time she came in, they were just like feeding her the ball and she was unconscious. This girl was on a mission. And then when it really came down to it, they set somebody else who then made an error. And this girl, she looked like she wanted to kill somebody, understandably. Your team is on the ropes and you are like hitting 1,000 from that point on, and then they set somebody else and they mess it up. Come on.
Well, I think it was, if my memory serves me correctly, they ran a middle ball on that one and she was blocked for the game. You've got a hot hand on a right side who single-handedly won you the last set. I don't care if everybody in the gym knows the ball is going to her. You go, here, you have the chance to win or lose for us. I was shocked at that set selection.
It was fun to tune in for the end of that. A 4-5 matchup, can you consider it an upset? Not really. It's pretty close.
So this was a bit more of an upset. We had Texas A&M beat Arizona State, which was a 3-6 matchup, and they won 3-1. We had Logan Lednicki hit 500 on 48 swings for Texas A&M.
That'll do it.
Yeah, seriously. You don't need anything else to happen other than for that stat line to be true.
Get your serves in, please.
Now, I will say they had 19 more digs than Arizona State, which gives you a ton of attacking opportunities that your opponent doesn't get. But other than that, the stats across the board were pretty similar, other than the team hitting percentage, which was 303 for Texas A&M and 181 for Arizona State. I think when you have two teams that are generally balanced teams, one player having a great night can often tip the scales. And in this case, Lednicki was able to do that.
In the last round two matchup that we didn't fully watch, Dayton beat Baylor 3-2 to make their first regional semifinal ever, which is very exciting.
Stats-wise, this match was very close when we looked at service errors, service aces. Blocks were 8-8. We had 66 digs to 62 digs. Hitting percentages were very similar. Dayton hit 275 as a team. Baylor was 282. Again, for me, this match came down to execution after 20 and who was able to make plays.
Almodovar from Dayton, 34 kills. Pretty good numbers, if you ask me. I think the surprising thing, though, is Elise McGee was held to pretty low points. And Baylor kind of leans heavily on her for the most part.
So I think we hadn't really watched a ton of Dayton. And again, for me, this was one of the realizations that we need to watch a few more mid-major teams throughout the season so that we have an idea of what their strengths are and what their matchups are going to be.
I mean, again, this was a 4-5 matchup, so big upset? No. It was upsetting to me in my bracket, however, because I had not watched Dayton, so I'm like, you know what, let's go with what I know. Big mistake.
Well, and I did the same thing. If I looked at two teams who were matched up, I did some quick research, and then I looked at the conference, and that was kind of how I made those choices, where I hadn't watched the team play a ton.
So most weeks, we watch a whole bunch of matches, and then we pick a couple that we really want to talk about that we found to be interesting or noteworthy. This week, we watched a ton of matches. And when we were looking at each other, like, which ones do we talk about, we couldn't decide, which is why we're kind of touching on all of them. So this week we're getting, like, the brief overview of, like, all the matches we watched without diving too deep. Because, to be quite honest, teams are playing their best volleyball right now. And there weren't many matches that we watched and we were just, like, confused about the decision making or things like that, like we are on a typical conference week, let's say. So we're just doing it all because we couldn't decide.
Well, let's look at the TCU Oregon match to start. This match, in my opinion, coming in was going to be all about Melanie Parra and how she played.
I mean, it always is for TCU, quite frankly.
And I think when a team is that reliant on one player, the further along the season you get, the more video there is, the more you can collect and prepare for a player, the harder it is to win. And I think we saw that in this match.
Well, I mean, TCU won the first set, and Parra put up great numbers. And then kind of, you know, slowed down as Oregon as a whole kind of picked up steam. And it's wearing. When you have a team coming at you, stopping and focusing on one player, I mean, it's a lot.
And we definitely saw Oregon make some good adjustments. They moved their block around. They got touches. They adjusted serving strategies. They just made it really hard for her, and TCU couldn't find another player to step up and take some of that load.
I think I picked TCU to beat Oregon because I'm like, she can do it. She can fight through this match. Oregon proved me wrong. Mimi Collier had a great game. It was a good team effort.
Yeah, I agree. And I had Oregon in my bracket, so I was really happy about that.
I think I mixed them up. I picked TCU for one and Oregon for one. Oregon's got a tough one coming up against Pitt, so we will see what happens.
Let's talk about Kentucky-Minnesota. We hadn't watched Kentucky play all year, so I was really looking forward to see what they were able to do. We know Minnesota. We know the faults and flaws that they have. But Minnesota is one of those teams where in the back of your mind, you're always thinking, man, if they put it together, they're going to be really good. So I was really looking forward to watching this match.
Kentucky absolutely destroyed Minnesota in the first set.
They are big.
Brooklyn Delay showed up. The middles started off really strong for Kentucky. I think the offense was like really well balanced. And again, we say it every single week. When you run the middles early, it kind of sets you up for success, and it sets your outside hitters up for success later on in the match. They definitely did slow down a little bit in the second.
It was really interesting watching this match. It kind of looked like Minnesota was disengaged in the first set, and that was evident by the score of 25-11 for Kentucky. And I wasn't sure after that set if Minnesota was going to find anything in this match.
I was surprised that they kind of figured it out. And sets 2, 3, and 4 were kind of representative of the match I expected when I saw that these teams were playing each other. I was impressed at how balanced Kentucky's offense was, especially like Jordan Daly. She is young, but she hit 563 on 16 swings. Brooke Boltema had 20 swings. Her percentage wasn't as high, but like her energy was contagious, and she like really brought it, and I liked to see that. Brooklyn Delay, like, she's been the go-to player for them all season.
And she delivered.
She did 18 kills on 45 swings, 267. Like, decent night for sure. Her spin serve is definitely hit or miss. It's either an ace or an error. We're not, and nothing in between here.
Well, and you can have a couple players like that when you have the rest of your team is relatively consistent. So I think they have a good balanced makeup, but I'm not sure what's going to happen for them after this round. I thought for Minnesota, Julia Hansen played pretty well. I thought she was one of their best players. Again, I don't think anybody from Minnesota was good in the first set, but after that, she scored. She was fearless. She was going after the block, and Kentucky's a big team. So I thought she played well.
I mean, typical that we always see with Minnesota, they do not set their middles, hardly at all. We had 15 sets between the two of them for the entire match, which is wild. I mean, Minnesota blocked well. That is their strength. We know that. But as we also see a lot with Minnesota, when a team needs a point, tip it, usually in the middle of the court, and it will land.
So I think Kentucky was definitely prepared. And I didn't see Minnesota do anything differently than they normally do. And they just don't seem to be firing on all cylinders as a team.
Yeah, something definitely seemed off there. There was a definite lack of eye contact between players. There was very little, you know, togetherness and unity. They're out of system setting also, like aside from the intangible things. The number of unhittable balls I saw, it was unacceptable.
I definitely think Kentucky was the better team in that match, and they deserved to win. They looked more prepared. They looked like they had more fight, and they ran a really balanced offense.
Based on what you guys know, that I am not a Minnesota fan, particularly this season. So given what we've been observing this season and where I thought they fit in the big picture, I think that this is exactly where they should have finished. But again, Kentucky is going to take on Missouri for an SEC battle in the regional semifinal. So we'll see what happens in that one. Speaking of Missouri, probably the biggest round two upset, arguably, was number 7 Missouri taking down the 2 seed in SMU 3-1.
I'm so mad about this because I picked Missouri as my dark horse team, and then I didn't follow through with my bracket picks. I'm so upset at myself for this.
I'm so upset with Adam too, because here we are talking big about Missouri for I don't even know how long. And then it comes to bracket time, and I'm like, oh my gosh, Missouri and SMU could match up. I think I'm going to pick Missouri. And what does this guy say? He's a traitor, is what he is. He's like, oh, SMU is going to beat them for sure. And I'm like, wait, no, we've been talking about how Missouri's so good. Like, I really think that they can win. And this man convinced me to change my bracket pick. It's unforgivable.
I'm so upset. And the only reason I thought about that was because Missouri seemed to peter a little bit towards the end of conference play, and I just didn't know if they were going to get it back. And I should have trusted my gut, and I didn't, and I'm upset about it.
But speaking of connectedness and teamwork, Missouri is that.
I loved watching them.
They were in it together. You could tell they just had this fight, this we are taking this, eye contact, you know, attitude, swagger. Like, that was a team on the court.
This match was so much fun to see because you had two teams that, in my opinion, don't necessarily have a standout star. So it was really team versus team. And the sets, for the most part, were close, other than the second one. And you saw these teams just scrapping it out. I loved watching this match.
So Nia Shimei for SMU, I thought, was outstanding. I don't think I've seen so many clean kills in my life.
She was untouchable.
Like, the defense, like, just straight into the floor. No block touch, no defensive, like, just straight down.
She hit 487 on 39 swings, 22 kills, only 3 errors. It was impressive to watch. And I know I just mentioned there were no stars on the court, but she stepped up in this role, and she was the reason it was close.
100%. I thought Okamore blocked well. I thought she was lacking offensively. Foster, usually relied upon for her serving, to me, it felt a little off. And Tabron,
she was okay.
No, she like made appearances sometimes, and then she like went into a hole sometimes, particularly at the end of set 3.
Well, and I think her passing struggled.
SMU was up, what was it, 24-22 or 24-21 in set 3. Missouri sided out, then proceeded to ace Tabron twice in a row. And that is when we kind of saw the back and forth happening. And that the end of that third set was very exciting.
Well, that set went to 33-31. And SMU kept their season alive by pulling that one out.
But that's what I'm mentioning about her just like going into a hole. Like, she started set 1 well, she was scoring well, and then she would just disappear. And then she'd reemerge and come back and then disappear, as we saw at the end of set 3. And it just, so she was like pretty inconsistent in my opinion. But then Natalie Perdue stepped up from the service line. Then they kept her in offensively. So they were trying to make adjustments. But I think, you know, the person that kind of held it together for me for SMU was Shimei.
Oh, hands down. This match, looking at the numbers, was incredibly interesting because they were almost identical. You have Missouri had 46 digs to 45. You had the blocks were 12 to 10. And the difference in the match was the serving. And Missouri was relentless. Both teams made 14 errors, but Missouri had 11 aces to SMU's 1. That is a huge difference maker. And it not only are the aces points straight out, but it just goes to show the serving pressure that Missouri was able to put on SMU throughout the whole match.
11 to 14 is an impressive, like, ace 11 to aces ratio. To 14 errors. That's an impressive ace to error ratio. 1 to 14. And you're playing at home. That's the kicker for me, is you were playing at home. Granted, I believe they were at a neutral location. They were at the Metroplex. I don't know if that's like their home gym usually. Somebody tell me. 1 ace to 14 errors.
Not the best.
Not the best.
I thought Michael Vernon was spectacular to watch. She has got swagger. She is dynamic. She's got a little attitude on her, which I love to see. She hit 308 on 52 sets, 23 kills, and she led the way for them. I will say their setter is probably the backbone of their team, just from an attitude and a driving force perspective, but Vernon led the way in terms of their offense.
Gosh, I just want to look at her and be like, when you don't think and just jump and swing, you're unstoppable. It's like sometimes she'll jump and you'll see her like kind of try to look for the block or defense or something and like delay her swing. That's when she makes mistakes. But when she just jumps and goes and doesn't like hitch her arm, it's not, it's like so much smoother to me and so much more effective. She had periods where the hitch came in. Yeah, she was fun to watch.
It's interesting talking about her, and we talked about the professional leagues. For me, watching her play, she's going to have the ability to play at the next level if she wants to, but that hitch in her arm swing is going to be the difference between whether she makes a successful pro or whether she struggles at that next level.
I think Jordan Iliff also played awesome, aced SMU off the court.
Yeah.
She served outstanding. She scored well. So Vernon and Iliff kind of like held it together from an offensive perspective. I think Janet Demaray also.
That was the best I think I've seen her play.
Yeah, she's been like steady, but I think that she played really well.
The thing I liked about this match was players were going for kills. There wasn't a lot of play it safe. Both teams were swinging to win and had that attitude of, I want to score this point. And I love watching volleyball like that. No tips, no play it safe. The athletes put the game on the line and wanted to be set. I thought this match was incredibly entertaining. The margins were very small and you had players making plays. And this was the epitome of college sport to me. You could see the passion the athletes had and were playing to go on to the next round. This was probably my favorite match to watch this weekend.
Well, and it goes back to what I said before, is like watching these matches and this match in particular, we weren't looking at each other like, what are they thinking or what is going on here? It was just like good volleyball. Both teams were playing well. Obviously, there are dips and blips and errors that happen along the way, but like, this is what you want to see from NCAA tournament time. And I said it before, I rarely cheer for the underdog. I want the higher seed teams to win because for any number of reasons, we can get into it another day. But this was just fun to watch. And I love, and we talked about it while we were watching, more and more girls are getting that attitude and that swagger and that stare down, and I love it. Because when I was playing college, it was frowned upon. And I got in so much trouble when I did it, and like, you're a bad sport. No, you're a competitor. You're intense. And I love seeing so many girls that play now kind of have that intensity and that firepower behind them.
Vernon had a couple blocks where she backpedaled real slow off the net, and I was loving
and
it.
And so did Marina Crownover.
Yep.
Like, I love it. Keep doing it. Make them feel it. Another match that we were very excited about when we saw the bracket was Florida versus Kansas. We were saying last week that based on Kansas's size, they could potentially have trouble dealing with Kennedy Martin. And we also kind of had questions about if the left side that was matched up with Martin would be effective offensively. We know that Kansas relies heavily on Anna Bonjo for their success, but we were wondering what was going to happen with Florida's outside hitters. I really enjoyed watching this match, and people, individual athletes, team from both sides, I think exceeded my expectations.
I agree that this match was more than I expected from certain players. I was very, I don't want to say worried is the wrong word, but I thought for Kansas, Caroline Bien was going to have a good match. And I don't think I've ever seen her play better. She was outstanding.
I thought she was going to struggle offensively. And she was probably the best attacker Kansas had.
I would agree with that.
Until the end of the fifth set. She became a different person. She became a completely different attacker at the end of the fifth set. When things became real and things were on the line, she tightened up. She wasn't fully swinging. She was half speeding. You could tell she didn't want to make a mistake. And I was like, keep doing what you were doing before. Like, it just, oh, my heart broke seeing that pressure get to her.
We also saw her watch several serves hit just behind her as she was passing.
I would say, what, at least five?
I was going to say five, if my memory serves me correctly. And the balls were not even close.
Even a follow, a turn and watch.
Yeah. It was like she was hoping they were going to be out of bounds. It was, your heart breaks for an athlete like that because she played so well. She elevated her game. She rose to the moment, but just couldn't get it over the edge. And it's interesting because I thought Kennedy Martin played incredibly well, but then you saw her have that same fear in the fifth set, but then she came out and she was able to overcome that and she started swinging again. And so that to me was a huge difference, and it was really interesting to see the difference between those two athletes and how they handled the moment.
Yeah, Kennedy Martin, I think, had 10 kills in the first set alone. She was blowing them up.
She hit the libero for Kansas one time in the shoulder, and it looked like she got shot.
The pace that she was hitting the ball, and not even the pace, it sounded different than anybody else. Like, that is a heavy ball, and you can just tell by the sound of it when it hits her hand. It was very obvious that Kansas had not kind of dealt with that heat in Big 12 play. Because the first set, they were just like getting pelted with balls. And they, to their credit, they settled in. And then they started controlling the digs a bit better. They got a read on the game. They knew how fast it was coming. So they made a great defensive adjustment. And Martin did slow down. We saw her like starting to tip a little bit in questionable moments.
I also thought part of that was the setting. There was stretches of inconsistencies where they were a little bit low. And then she was tipping. So I think it was a combination of a little bit of nerves and a little bit of not feeling in rhythm with the setter.
Fair. And then, but going back to what you were saying, in the fifth set, I will say that Martin, we sensed that she was feeling the pressure partway through. Florida got out to a huge lead in the fifth. They were up 5-1. Then Kansas made a push back to tie it up. And at that point, you kind of saw Martin start to play it safe. She wasn't putting the full heat on the ball. She was tipping some more. But to her credit, when it came down to it at the end, she re-found that aggression and she scored points down the stretch at the end.
And you love to see an athlete figure it out because she's a junior, I believe.
Sophomore.
She's a sophomore, so she's young. That experience is going to pay dividends for her. Although I do want to shout out the Florida libero, who made an outstanding dig at 13-12 in that fifth set. That was probably the play of the match for me.
Oh my gosh, she kept it. That she made two digs in that play. The first one was spectacular.
Ugh.
She's a record setter at Florida for a reason. I will say in set two, Florida had no business losing that set. They missed almost every serve.
Oh, it was insane.
It was insane. They couldn't get a serve in set two.
And I was worried that was going to continue and that Kansas was going to win the next three sets if they couldn't figure their serving out.
And somebody let me know, because we've only seen Florida play a couple times, and it was the same thing. So the same thing happened in all the times we've watched Florida play. They start the match with Taylor Park setting, and as soon as they lose a set, Stuckey comes in to finish the match. And we watched them play Missouri. Park started. They lost the first set to Missouri. Stuckey came in. This time, Florida won the first set and lost the second. Parks played both of those. And then in the third, Stuckey came in. So somebody tell me who has watched more Florida than we have. It seems to me that they're trying to manage Alexis Stuckey for her injury and just see how far Parks can get them in the match until they have to bring her in. That's my only explanation. But it's happened both times, so somebody let us know.
And I can understand that in conference play, but that is a bold move for tournament play, to just assume that somebody can come off the bench after two sets and run your offense and your hitters find rhythm. I mean, kudos to Alexis Stuckey for being able to do that and for the hitters. But that seems like a huge gamble because she played and she played well. You got to start her, I think. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next rounds.
I will say the Florida left sides did step up. They were question marks for me. AC Fitzpatrick was a blocking machine, which she needed to be because, I mean, if you're anybody playing Florida, you don't want to continuously run your offense into Martin and August. So obviously you would rather have AC Fitzpatrick blocking you than those two. She did her job blocking. So that was great to see. And then Isabel Martin scored very well, particularly when Kennedy Martin kind of slowed down a little bit. That's when she stepped up. And that is what Florida is going to need to see from her moving forward.
She was the question mark for me going into this match. And she was, let's call it, the key to success. If they could balance their offense at the pins, Florida was going to be tough to beat. And I thought she was very good.
Ana Bonjo for Kansas played well. She showed up as she had to if Kansas wanted to even have a chance.
El Nadi was El Nadi. You get the same thing from her no matter where or when or how she's playing. But I thought London Davis needed to be a little bit better for them. She only went 115. She had 26 attempts but 6 errors and only 9 kills. For me, she needed to score a few more points in those big moments. And you mentioned Fitzpatrick. She made the plays down the stretch that London Davis would have needed to make for Kansas to win.
And I'm going to shout out Cameron Turner. I've been very critical of her since we started this podcast. She took a swing on 2.
Ooh.
At like the most ballsy time. And it was very well done. She got pulled forward in the gap between 2 blockers, and she unloaded on that ball. I think it was like 13-12 or something.
And I don't think she had hit a ball.
She hadn't. She was saving it up for that exact moment.
I think you and I just stopped and looked at each other and was, kudos. That was awesome.
Again, like another really fun match to watch.
High level of execution.
You saw some ups and downs from individual players during that match. You saw ups and downs from Florida's serving during that match. Big plays were made when they needed to happen, and players stepped up that we didn't expect. So, again, this is what you want to see from at tournament time.
So our last match was probably the result that was the most surprising for me personally.
Apologies to you and I for thinking that Louisville was going to roll through this match 3-0. I was very impressed.
It was, you and I might have been the most fundamentally sound and consistent that I've seen in these first 2 matches.
I think I said to you like triple digit times during that match, their fundamentals are so good. It's the fundamentals. They're so disciplined. And you're like, yeah, I heard you the first 99 times you said that.
To me, the thing I noticed that I haven't seen a ton of other teams do, and granted, we don't always have the best angle to see this, but their block position adjusted based on the pass and the hitters that were in the front row very, very well. So they had a 2-man block up and solid on almost every play. They made life for the Louisville outside hitters miserable.
They understood the assignment. They played the percentages. They did their homework. They knew where the ball was going in different situations. And honestly, Louisville's one of the best blocking teams in the country. They kept up with them block for block until set 4, where Louisville kind of went off for a while there. They were head-to-head, numbers-wise, blocking.
Not only from a total blocks number was UNI impressive, the number of slowdowns and touches and good touches they got on Louisville's hitters was incredibly impressive and doesn't show up on the stat sheet, but was a huge difference maker in this match.
Across the board, I thought that I was impressed with their libero, and especially in set 1, like the control of the digs from UNI. In front of the 10-foot line, not too close to the net. Like, they were in control of everything they were doing. The thing that shocked me most was when they were like, Oh, yes, she is the co-libero of the year. Oh, yes, this player is the co-player of the year. I'm sorry. Who else is as good as these players in that conference? Because these athletes were solid.
I still don't think we can give them enough credit. Now, fun fact, as to maybe why they were so prepared for this match. I believe the coach for UNI, I believe her daughter plays for Louisville. Correct. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that she's probably watched every Louisville game this season.
And she probably knows all the juice of what is going on in that team.
So I thought that was a cool little addition to that match. The thing that really impressed me about UNI was how fearless their hitters were. And I kept wondering, you know, when is the moment going to get here? You don't play in necessarily the strongest conference. You're smaller than Louisville. You're less experienced. And I kept thinking, when are you going to tip the ball? When are you going to take a swing off? And they never did. They just never did. They swung aggressively to score points against a bigger block all match.
I have a lot of respect for that. Those hitters were, as you said, fearless. Louisville put up a record number of blocks, like the most blocks they've had in a match since, I want to say, 2016 or something like that.
25 stuffed blocks on the match.
They kept coming because they knew that that was what they had to do to win. Against a good team, you have to keep pushing. You have to take it. And a good team will score their points. Louisville will get their blocks. But they did not stop, and they were varying up their attacks. They were switching the angles. You know, Elena Scott got off to a great start defensively for Louisville. Great, outstanding digs. It was wild. Okay, we're going to switch up the angle. We're going to make a change. And then another player was able to find rhythm. They had a plan, and they stuck to it. And I was so impressed. And then they had match point. And we kept looking at each other like, when is this moment going to become too much? And it was when they had match point. All of a sudden, it became real. All of a sudden, it became, we're going to win this match. We can beat a number one seed. They could not get a serve in.
They missed 4 serves on match point.
It was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking to watch. Like, they were so in it and fearless. I keep saying that word, but it just fits.
Well, and the crazy thing to me was they would miss a serve and then they would have a fearless swing. And then they would miss a serve and they would go back and swing again. It was almost as if those 4 seconds at the baseline just overwhelmed them in that moment.
And that's where you saw the difference, is because, I mean, set 5 went 22-20. Louisville didn't miss a serve.
And it's wearing.
And that's the difference. This Louisville has been there. Louisville knows how to deal with that pressure and that scrutiny. And you and I didn't. And that was the difference, is Louisville executed the things that were in their complete control. And quite frankly, serving is the only thing in volleyball that is completely in your control. They took care of it, and you and I didn't.
And I think the other thing that's interesting from a non-volleyball perspective that maybe some people don't think about is there is added pressure when you're a number one seed and you're hosting the Final Four. And I think we talked about this earlier with the team. I think Louisville came in expecting this to be a little bit more of an easier match than it was. And you saw a little bit of a laissez-faire attitude in the first set, to their credit. And I think Anna DeBeer helped bring them around. They entered the dogfight and they showed up. But you have to think about, hey, we're going to lose this match. We're playing at home. How embarrassing is the wrong word, but we're hosting and we don't make it. And all of those factors play in, and they were able to rise up and manage the moment in a very tough situation because you and I was unconscious.
You and I was quite balanced. I was impressed with their middle, their outsides, their right side. Louisville's middles blocked well. They were not effective offensively, in my opinion. I didn't think the Louisville right sides showed up in the way they had to offensively. Charity Looper and Anna DeBeer, Elena Scott, those three held it together for Louisville. But I think moving forward, they're going to need to figure this out. Like, they are not going to have a walk in the park with Purdue anytime. But if their middles and right sides are not scoring consistently, it's going to be a struggle. And, you know, to Anna DeBeer's credit, Louisville was down 14-12. She had a fearless swing. She had got a block. Like, she got them back in the game. And that's, like, we've seen that from her more than a few times now. Like, it's not a fluke. So she is definitely that player for them. You know, Elena Scott, outstanding defensively.
Great setting.
Her setting, I say it every time I watch them. Somebody tell us, was she a setter in club or something? Because,
her location's incredible. Very accurate, very hittable. Always putting her hitters in a position to swing when they're out of system. It's fun to watch.
So, yeah, Louisville's blocking, very good. The outsides, Elena Scott, solid. But they're going to need more from their middles and right sides in the next rounds. I hope you guys had as much fun as we did watching round two. Wow. I know I was getting a lot of comments on Instagram asking what we were watching. So I know that you guys were into it as well. So it's going to be very, very fun to see how the regional semifinals play out this week.
So we had a few questions come in this week as people have been watching matches and really involved in the NCAA tournament. And so we wanted to address a few of those and maybe give some background information for people who don't necessarily know all the terms or all of the things they're hearing while they're watching the broadcasts.
So one question that came in that I think is very important to address, especially if you're watching more volleyball, is what is the difference between a 6-2 and a 5-1? And broadcasters and announcers use these terms all the time. And if you're not sure what they mean, it can obviously be very confusing because they are used frequently. So 6-2, 5-1 is the system that a particular team is running. And so the first number that you hear refers to the number of hitters that a team uses, and the second number refers to the number of setters they use. So if a team is running a 6-2, it means that they have six players that they use as attackers, and they have two players that they use as setters.
Practically what that looks like is the setters will play the rotations in the back row. So if the setter starts in one, they'll play three rotations. When they rotate to the front, the teams will do a double sub where a right side will come in and play in the front row, and then the right side that rotated back will come out for the next setter. So your setters are only playing three rotations, and they're always setting from the back.
When you hear 5-1, that means that a team utilizes five hitters and one setter. So in this scenario, you see the setter play all six rotations. So obviously when the setter's in the front row, they're not attacking. So of the players on the court, five of them are hitting and one is setting, which is why when the setter's in the front row, two people are hitting. When the setter's in the back row, three people are hitting. So hopefully that clears that up a little bit. The next question we got was, why do players tip so much even if the set isn't bad?
This is a great question, and I think there are several possible options. One of them we talked about is certain players don't love to make mistakes. And so when they find themselves in a situation that's uncomfortable or they have a big block in front of them, instead of swinging and being aggressive, they will tip to keep the rally going in order to not make a mistake and see if they can continue the rally. The other reason people tip is if there is something that the team has identified as a defensive weakness of their opponent. So if a team plays defense on the perimeter where all of their back row players are kind of on the outside of the court, you'll see teams attack the middle of the court with a tip in an effort to score. You might also see a player tip to the setter to try and take them out of the rally or force an out of system set. And that can also be a strategic play when you don't necessarily have a kill swing in front of you.
And the last question we're going to answer is, what is the purpose of a short serve if it doesn't seem to disrupt anything? I love this question. So there are numerous reasons why a team would utilize a short serve. The first one would be to disrupt attacking routes. So in many rotations, you'll see the middle and an outside hitter kind of clumped together, and middles have to like typically run across the whole court if they're running behind the setter. And so if you're serving short, you are kind of trying to disrupt their timing to not be able to run their route smoothly. Another option would be to make life difficult for a player who has to serve, receive, and then attack. So if they have to run up to pass a short ball, it becomes more difficult for them to get outside and get a nice strong approach. So you're trying, even if the pass may be perfect, and even if it looks like a team is still in system, teams are trying to limit options. So if a team typically has three attackers, by making life difficult for their outside hitter, they can focus on the other hitters. And it just really helps limit all the things that a block and defense have to look at. Another option, and the final thing I'll talk about, is a team might choose to do this to just disrupt passing rhythm. If you're seeing the same type of serve all match, it's really easy to get into a rhythm, and then it's very straightforward to deliver perfect passes. If you're forced to run forward and then they might serve deep again, like now you're unsure and you're on your toes and you're less steady with what is coming at you. And we saw this actually in set four in the Louisville and Northern Iowa match. Louisville started serving short in set four, and you and I, who had been passing very well all match, all of a sudden started passing off the net because Louisville was forcing them to move forward and backward in that scenario. So hopefully those answers help clear things up for you guys. We love getting your questions, so please be sure to keep them coming.
We had a great week of volleyball this week, and it's only going to get better from here. We're going to have high-level matches Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There's going to be a lot to watch, and it's going to be super exciting. So a couple of the matches that Sarah and I are looking forward to. On Thursday, we have Kentucky and Missouri. I'm not going to pick a winner on that one because I'm not going to bet against Missouri, but I think Kentucky's playing really well. So that one's going to be fun to watch. And then after the Florida-Stanford match, probably around 9:30 or 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, we're going to see Louisville-Purdue, which I think is going to be a great game. And then on Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern, we have Creighton and Texas facing off in the State College Regional Semifinal, and that's also on ESPN2. This match is going to potentially be, I would say, a passing of the baton, as Creighton has had an exceptional season. Texas won the last two titles. It'll be interesting to see the dynamics, which team shows up, whether Creighton can rise to the occasion. That's going to be a fun one.
I'm just going to say, my first two rounds of my bracket were a bloodbath, but my picks for the Elite Eight are still alive, so I've got a lot kind of riding on these regional semifinal matches because, man, I am low in the ranks in the Volley Talk bracket challenges. Even though I tried to make some sneaky picks, I shouldn't have. What was I thinking? Anyway, obviously, Saturday and Sunday are the regional finals. Pittsburgh and Louisville regionals are happening on Saturday. Both of those matches are on ESPN2. The Lincoln and State College regionals are on Sunday. The Lincoln regional is being shown on ABC, and the State College regional is being shown on ESPN. Now, obviously, all of these matches in the regional semifinals have the potential to be outstanding, but the ones that Adam highlighted are the ones that we are particularly looking forward to and that we think have great potential. Because of the time of the final match, there is a high likelihood that next week's episode is going to be released on Tuesday morning or potentially later in the day on Monday. So if your download doesn't show up first thing Monday morning, that is why it might be impossible for us to get this recorded, to get it out to you Monday morning.
And you know we're not going to skip a match.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you would leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will be back next week.